Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. For this week's episode of the Entheogenic Evolution, I am joined by Andrew Daniel. He's the author of the book Awaken to Your True Self and is also the director of the Center for Cinesomatic Development, which is the primary topic of our conversation today here on the podcast. We spoke about a month and a half ago and had a great conversation, and I'm very much looking forward to bringing it to you today. Just going to go ahead and mention his website right off the bat here before we get into other announcements. It's cinesomatics.org, and that's cinesomatics.org. So we'll be getting to that in just a minute, but of course, first there are announcements. Let's start with giving thanks. Always a good thing. I'd like to thank Brooke and James, who have once again come through and made their monthly donation in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast via a monthly PayPal donation that both of them make. Thank you very much, Brooke and James. Your support is always appreciated, and your names get mentioned here in the podcast once a month and have been so for probably at least the past few years or so, because you guys are really solid on that. So thank you so much. Don't have anybody else from PayPal to thank for this week, but I do have Jennifer to thank, who made a very generous contribution and actually asked for my mailing address so she could send me a check personally, and it arrived over this past week. And thank you so much, Jennifer, for that very generous support. So let's talk a minute about support. As I mentioned, every week, this is a listener-supported podcast, and you know, beyond the podcast, I do spend a lot of time writing books, working on books, publishing books, making the audio books, and I spend a lot of time making music and making art, which gets used in both the printed books and the ebooks and in the audio books. And I spend a lot of time doing photography, which I then use in the art that gets used in the books and on the covers and all the rest of it. And so just want to say that I do spend a lot of my time doing creative activities to bring content to you out there in listener land and elsewhere out in the world via books and lectures and interviews and talks and art and music and all the rest of that. And as an independent artist and creator that, I rely on the support of those who enjoy my work. And a lot of the time that I'm spending on my work is not directly paid in any way. And that's why, I'm always talking up, make a donation to the podcast, join up over as a supporter at Patreon. And of course, especially for my supporters at Patreon, I always try and give back to those who support me and not just sit back and, okay, people are supporting me and now I'm just going to make art and music and write books and stuff like that. But as I always mention, that at my top two tiers of patrons, that you can get a 30-minute call with me every month or an hour call with me every month. And over there at Patreon, I have levels of support everywhere from $1 a month up to the highest tier at $100 per month that gets you that hour check-in call with me. And it's a great way to support me, to support the work that I'm doing. And just as always, great thanks to everyone over there at Patreon who does support me everywhere from that bottom tier of $1 a month up to $100 a month. That your support makes a huge, huge, huge difference in my life and my availability to be able to spend the hours and days and weeks and months that it takes to make these creative, expressive, educational products to share with the world, which I make largely available for free, because that's how the internet works these days, right? So anyway, that's just my plug for myself and asking for your support. If you like the stuff that I do, then I invite you to show a little support. You can stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net. There is a PayPal link at the top right of the page if you want to make a one-time donation. And there's also a link to my Patreon page, which is patreon.com/martinwball. And you can sign up at the monthly level that is comfortable for you. And of course, you can always change that at any time. There is no commitment. There's no requirement. And you can come in and out as you like. All of that is available. And of course, I'm also available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultation calls to help you prepare for or integrate your entheogenic experience from a non-dual and energetic perspective. It's always interesting. Every week, I get different clients from all around the world with all different levels of experience and different kinds of questions and things that they're looking for with support and help and integration. And it's always a pleasure. And I'm always happy to talk to you if you need someone to talk to who can help you understand and integrate what it is that you're going through. And I know that it can be confusing, and that's why I'm here to help, and I'm always happy to do so. Okay. Speaking of, you know, all the creativity and all that stuff. So I've been very busy making music to go with the audiobook of The Fate of Mirani. So I'm working on The Fate of Mirani, the soundtrack. I've already got 9 songs done. I've released 2 of them as a single that are now out there everywhere you get digital music. And that's under the name of The Prophet. And of course, it has to do with elements in the story. It is not an overtly religious song in any way, but I invite you to check out that song. I'm going to be putting that at the end of the interview with Andrew today. So share that new musical creation with you guys. But if you want to go out there and get it, it's available at Apple Music, YouTube, you know, Spotify, all the places you get digital music. And really looking forward to completing the album. Not sure when that's going to be, but I've got some time this coming week, so looking forward to making some more music, and then we'll see when it's done, and that will allow me to finish the audiobook and release that, and yay, that will be so exciting. And, you know, as an artist and as a creator, there's nothing that I really love more than being deep in a creative project and just kind of fulfilling that urge to create and to share and to make things of beauty and wonder and awe. And so I'm deep in that with the music right now and really enjoying myself, so happy to share that song with you. Also, last thing I want to mention before we get into the talk with Andrew is that I am going to be speaking tomorrow with Tom Hatzis, who has been featured here on the podcast many, many times, but we're going to speak again tomorrow about the upcoming Sanctum Psychedelic Conference, which is going to be happening this July, July 21st through 23rd in Portland, Oregon. And I'll just give you the website. It's sanctum.org, and that's with a P, because that's cool, PSANCTUM.org. And I'm happy to say that Tom has invited me to come and speak at this conference. There's going to be Dennis McKenna and all kinds of other people. It's this 3-day event happening here in the Pacific Northwest. And it's one of the few places that have invited me to speak recently. So thank you very much for that, Tom. I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm going to be speaking a little bit about the cultural history of 5-MeO-DMT and how we got from totally obscure, no one really knew what it was, to one of the most prominent psychedelics in the world today. So I'm going to be giving some background and some history and talking about what's been taking place there. But anyway, Tom's going to be on the show. We're going to have a conversation tomorrow. I'm going to be talking about how Tom and his partner Eden are looking to make the Sanctum Psychedelic Conference accessible to everyone. You know, there's been some big conferences either just happening or coming up, such as the Breaking Convention Conference in London. There's the Big Maps Conference coming up in Denver. And, you know, the price tag to these things are hundreds, if not thousands of dollars for people to attend. And honestly, like, I can't afford that. That is like way out of my personal budget. I don't have funds to drop a couple grand to go to a conference and listen to people talk. I don't know if you do, but I certainly don't. And Tom doesn't either. And so he wants to make his conference open and accessible to everyone. And so we're going to be talking about his sponsorship program that he's got going and all the details about the conference. And it's something that I'm very happy to support. In a sense, it's kind of taking place of the Exploring Psychedelics Conference that I used to host here in Ashland, which I always put on for free and made available by donation. And we'd like to see that level of support for Tom and the work that he and Eden are doing up in Portland and in building up the Sanctum Psychedelic Conference. So again, that's July 21st through 23rd this year. So I encourage you to get involved and come on out and say hi. Anyway, I think that's enough talking. Let's get into the conversation with Andrew Daniel. I'll give you his website once more about the topic that we're going to be discussing, the cinesomatics.org. So cinesomatics.org. And it's all about how you carry your shit around in your body and your movements and your gestures and your tone of voice and all the rest of it. And he's got a very interesting approach to it. It's not directly about psychedelics, but it ties right in there and fits really nicely with a lot of things that I myself have tried to share about how we inhabit ourselves as embodied beings, how the ego, how the wounds, how the trauma, how it's all embodied, and by how working energetically and paying attention to our gestures and our posture and our movements and our sounds and our bodies, that we can start to process and release all of that stuff. And that's what Andrew is all about. So it's a great conversation. And again, putting in my new track, The Prophet, from The Fate of Marani, the soundtrack, which is still yet to be fully released. But if you want to check out what I have so far, just stop by my Bandcamp page at martinball.bandcamp.com. And the first 9 songs of that forthcoming album are already available to stream and download over there. All right, enough talk. Let's have more talk in terms of a conversation with Andrew Daniel. All right, well, my guest today on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast is Andrew Daniel. And he is the individual behind the Center for Cinesomatic Development, which is at cinesomatics.org. And so today we're going to be talking about a little bit of a different topic and hopefully relating it back to potential entheogenic or psychedelic experience or practice. But primarily we're focusing on somatics today and how we can transform trauma, unconscious patterns as they are embodied in the body, that's the place you embody stuff, and how through embodied movement you might be able to affect some transformations and hopefully bring it back around to the potential topic of how this might be incorporated within a psychedelic experience. But somatics has definitely been a topic here in the podcast, and it's gaining traction around the world as an approach to dealing with trauma. And of course, as my listeners know, that it's a big part of what I emphasize about non-duality, that my new phrase that I'm throwing around a lot with people, and I think it'll probably be a book title at some point, is embodying non-duality. It's not what you think. Because it's not what you think. It's not about what you think or how you think. It's about how you embody yourself. So that's what we're going to be dealing with today. So Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hey, Martin. Thank you. I loved everything that you just said. That was great.
Oh, awesome. Well, I'd like to just invite you to start just by introducing yourself and a little bit of your background or story, whatever you want to share there, and I'll pepper you with some questions. But let's start there with getting to know you.
Well, where should we start? Do you want to go back to the beginning, or we could tie it in with entheogens? You know, there's a lot of ground to cover, so you let me know what you think is going to be the most fun for you.
Yeah, well, what we're leading up to is the development of the cinesomatic approach. Yeah. And so maybe let's start there. Just what is your role within the cinesomatic approach? And then where did it come from? What experiences of yours helped you build this program and this technique?
Perfect. Got it. So let me share a little bit about what that is and who I am first. Yeah. And then we'll go into the story and how I got there.
Okay.
So my name is Andrew Daniel. I am the author of the book Awaken to Your True Self, and I am the founder of Cinesomatics. And Cinesomatics is a healing modality. It is a therapeutic modality. It's a philosophical approach. It's the whole package for life transformation. And this transformation occurs at all levels: the physical level, the emotional level, the mental level, and the spiritual and energetic levels. And the foundation of this approach is in the name. So cinesomatics. The cine comes from cinema, which is video, and also has its roots in Greek for the word for movement. And somatics, well, that's obvious, somatics of the body. So it is a approach where the fundamental technology is using video to record people moving in their body. Then we play that video back, and myself or other people in the group start to reflect back and give feedback on the shadow material, the stories, the mythologies, the archetypical energies that are running that person. but not from the head, not from a mental conscious place, but an unconscious somatic place. So that's cinesomatics as its kind of fundamental technology that it offers. And within that, there is a lot of fun stuff that I do as well. Not that that's not fun, but a lot more juicy things dealing with something that I would call lucid shamanism. Hmm. And so one of the definitions of a shaman is someone who walks the line between the conscious and the unconscious realms. And as you know, dealing in the realm of the unconscious and in the shamanic journeys, there's a lot of symbolism, a lot of symbolism. And so working with the body and doing energetic stuff in that way, we're able to help people see and confront that same symbolic data that you would get in a shamanic journey, but do so lucidly and do so consciously. And because of that, there's a twofold. One is it is incredibly confronting. So with a lot of the plant medicines, there is a choice up front where you say, all right, I choose to do this. And then it takes you where it's going to take you. It's guiding you. And so for people who are very stubborn or are not really willing to let go themselves, who have a really strong ego, it's super helpful because it just takes you. You go. You take it and you're off. Now, if you know what happens if you fight it, that's not – it usually doesn't end very well. So with cinesomatics in this lucid shamanism, the person has the conscious choice. And at each step, when I'm giving feedback and reflecting back to them this symbolic data, their ego can come in and fight it or not. And then there's a whole process we have around dealing with that. The second element is the integration, is that post shamanic journey, post psychedelics, there's an integration period. And that is a whole other skill set and part of the practice itself. And a lot of people, in my experience, what I've seen, don't have the container or the resources to have a very high quality integration, taking all of that symbolic data, felt experience, transcendental experience, and how does that actually change their life? How do they actually apply it? How does it integrate? And so this second element of the lucid shamanism, they're awake for it. So they're integrating in real time because the wisdom makes sense, because they're seeing themselves on video. They're making new choices in the moment. Their bodies are having the energy is moving through their bodies. They're having these emotional experiences, but they're aware of it all. They're aware of what it all means and how it applies to their life. How that symbolism, how that data that is coming through their bodies in that moment actually applies to their bank account, actually applies to their relationships. So that's getting into some of the juicier stuff with the lucid shamanism, how this has its tie-in with the entheogens. So let me just stop there for a little bit, and if you have any questions, we'll go from that.
Yeah, so there's definitely a number of topics there that I want to return to, and I'm just going to take a really quick diversion with a little bit of sharing. Going back to this last point of kind of how it applies to psychedelic work. Excuse me. I actually just got, just before this conversation, I was in a consultation with a psychedelic therapist facilitator in the Midwest of the United States. And he had approached me with the question of, What do we want to focus on when we're dealing with the question of integration? And he said, he kind of approached with, he said, a lot of people focus on this idea of grounding, of, okay, go do some yoga, do meditate more, get some acupuncture or something like that. And he said, what's your take on that? And the whole conversation that we just had was around precisely what you were describing now. Is I told him, well, what I do with people who are looking for integration is we always go immediately to how is your embodiment? What are you embodying? What is showing up unconsciously in your body patterns and how you are inhabiting and expressing energy and whether that is in alignment with the truths you uncovered about yourself within your psychedelic experience or whether you are falling back into old unconscious patterns. And that is where the discomfort and the difficulty with quote unquote integration is coming from. So it's not at all about grounding. That for me, that's kind of missing the point, that it's overlooking the question of embodiment. So I can see the immediate application of what you are presenting here to the process of working with psychedelics, not necessarily in the psychedelic event itself, but the process, meaning the preparation going in and how you're integrating afterwards. So I think the relevance is immediate and absolutely relevant. But before we return to these questions, I want to go back and prod you a little bit more. Let's hear a little bit more about Andrew and how Andrew came into all of this. So let's go ahead and get some backstory now, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the beginning.
Yes, let's. In the beginning, there was.
In the beginning. So my journey really began, I suppose, let's just talk with, I suppose, this lifetime or whatever. My mom had me with my biological father when they were 17. And so I was a child to very young parents. Mm. And in that beginning, there was a lot of chaos after I was born. So there was some level of a physical abuse from my biological father towards me, which led to the courts and lots and lots of drama. And so that was my first few years of life. And my stepfather came into the picture and came in and sort of saved the day and moved us away from that environment when I was 5. And I started school in a place that I was unfamiliar with. I didn't know anybody. Mm. And the one thing that set everything in motion was warts. On my fingers, I had warts. So I had a bunch of warts on my hands. Well, the kids were pretty vicious, as sometimes they may be.
Yes.
And so I was bullied for it. I was made fun of from it. I had people say like they were afraid of it. They didn't want me touching them. They didn't want to touch me. So there was a bit of this leper archetype. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot more now than I knew then. But then unknowingly, I took it personal. And I really latched on to this victim mentality. And I spent the next 12 years of my life, pretty much all through school, with low self-esteem, not having any friends. I would sit alone at lunch. I loved assigned seats when everyone else hated them because it forced people to sit next to me. Tripped in the hall with my books going everywhere, picked last in gym class. Any of those 80s or 90s teen movies, that was actually my life.
Yeah.
And so part of that led me to reject the stereotypes of people that bullied me. So those were the jocks.
Yeah.
Those were the preps. You know, those were the cool, popular kids. And that led me to finding solace in my mind. And so I went to computers, I went to video games, I went to books, and found a wonderful world there. And I learned a lot about computers, programming, that eventually led me to starting a software company at 18. I wrote a special effects, particle effects, and physics engine at 18 and built two versions of software. So that geeky thing that I was hiding out in eventually did pay off, but in the moment, it didn't. I was in a lot of pain. And I was into really nerdy things, video games, anime, Dragon Ball Z, just Dungeons and Dragons, just Star Wars, just the typical nerd kind of thing. And luckily, my dad, I got some of that from him, and so he was very supportive in there. And my family did everything they could, and so I'm very grateful for that. But I was still in a lot of suffering. Mm-hmm. And when I got to my later teenage years, I was in a lot more pain because not only did people in general not like me, but girls did. Mm. And I had my first crush at like 4 years old, this cute girl in kindergarten. And for the next 11 years, I was consistently rejected. Or if by an off chance I wasn't and they liked me, I was so completely wackadoodle and low self-esteem at that time that I ruined it. I mean, there are times where these girls liked me and I was just so oblivious that I talked them out of liking me. And so, you know, hormones kicking in, sex and social life, and then teen movie pressures, all of this came to a head and I was in a lot of pain. And there was revenge fantasies, you know, wanting to go to the school and seek revenge. A lot of anger, a lot of pain, pissed off at my parents, hated myself, hated everyone. Emo kid. I don't know if you know emo music, but I was So just really dark, depressed, sad, pathetic kind of stuff. And so I got to the point in my life where the ending it fantasies came in, the suicides ideations came in. And fortunately, I was too much of a chicken to do it. I realized that, gosh, that sounds really painful. I don't think I want to go through that. That sounds not fun. So in a way, my cowardice saved my life. And so I said, all right, well, if I'm not going to end it, then I guess I have to do whatever it takes to figure this out. I guess I have to figure out how to be happy, how to get girls to like me, how to have friends, how to not hate myself and everyone, how to not have all this anger. And so that set me on a self-help personal development journey. And it literally started with going on to the really early days of Google, typing in how to be cool, how to get girls to like you, how not to be a loser. And, you know, of course, back then it was just filled with absolute trash. Oh, just be yourself, you know, like whatever, which is ultimately the best advice. But in almost all contexts that it is said, it is very unhelpful.
Yeah.
I mean, a book is literally called Awaken to Your True Self. So at the ultimate form of be who you really are, it works. But so much of us have such distance between that, it can be an excuse just to not do anything, to not show up, change.
Yeah. Or to lean into kind of the dysfunctional self, like, whoa, well, this is me being myself, right?
Enabling it, yeah.
Yeah, so it definitely is. It's the end goal, but it's the advice then misses, well, what is the process that gets you there? How do you do that? Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's essentially the very beginning. And from about 17 years old, I would say to, I think 29. So about 12 years, I was doing self-help, personal development. I was learning about dating, social skills. I did meditation. I did all the healing modalities. I had a huge awakening on psilocybin. That was my first ever psychedelic experience. So a lot happened. There's lots of more story in there, but I want to fast forward a little bit to the cinesomatic part. So that's my origin story. That's where my kind of healer's wound came from.
Yeah. And let me just say, Andrew, thank you very much for sharing all of that and revealing these aspects of yourself, which shows a level of comfort and maturity that you have with yourself now, that you're able to speak about all of this and share all of this and not be coming from a place of shame or self-loathing. And so I want to thank you for that and congratulate you for that. And also I'll just share with you my first crush as a little boy was Batgirl. Like, oh my God, Batgirl was so sexy. And I'm talking about like the old Batman, you know, like Bam, Plow. You know, same bat time, same bat channel. That, man, she was hot. And actually, there was an element where I put a cape on, and I can remember this when my mom took me to the grocery store, and I was like sitting in the grocery cart, and like the cashier was like, "Oh, cute, you're a little superhero. Like, who are you?" And my response was, "I'm Batgirl." And that was my way of like inhabiting my crush over Batgirl. Was like, I put on a cape. It's like, yeah, I'm Batgirl. And, you know, so I could definitely identify with the misunderstood youth who feels out of place. And, you know, I experienced a lot of bullying in my time as a child and not really knowing what was my place. By the time I hit high school, it was like just all the misfits, all the outcasts and misfits. That was my group of friends. And, you know, I didn't go through self-loathing and self-hate in the way that you've described, but I know what it feels like to be an outcast and to not really understand what is my place and how do I be my true self in a way that others can be comfortable with and I can be comfortable with and find one's place. So anyway, I always like to share. And so that's my sharing.
I like the story. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so let's now the cinesomatic, we can go ahead and talk about the sort of the origins of that and the development of that and how these previous tools that you encountered, how they led you into this.
Well, first, thank you for the acknowledgement. It's been a long journey getting here.
Yeah.
It's cost a lot of money, time, and it's been my hero's journey of a lifetime up to this point. And then having a business from that and then teaching it and getting this out into the world has been a whole nother phase of that, because it's a whole different thing healing yourself than it is being an entrepreneur and an author and a teacher and getting that out into the world. But I realized that I had to do it myself first.
Mm-hmm.
I can appreciate teachers and healers and people that haven't done the work first and still manage to help people. I'm sure there's some good ideas. But for me, there was no way I could guide somebody through the deepest, darkest aspects of their shadow unless I was willing to do that myself first.
Yeah.
And so it was 10 to 15 years of doing the work myself first, and then trying in vain to teach it and to share it and having things before I actually reached success and being able to help people and make a living from it. So the journey to get there is part of the journey to cinesomatics. So as I told you, from 17, I started learning all of this stuff and doing all this personal development. I was trained in NLP, hypnotherapy, EFT. I did life coaching. I did neuroemotional technique. I did plant medicines. I did traditional therapy. I mean, a lot of stuff. Pretty much all the alternative holistic things out there. I did not take any pharmaceutical drugs. So I was very blessed. We actually didn't have money or insurance or, you know, we just didn't even have the means to do it. So that was another blessing in disguise, because being numbed out on pharmaceutical drugs would have been very, very bad for me. So through that journey, I told you I was that geek. I learned computers, learned programming and web design. So I had a software company, started at 18. I ran that for about 7 years. Fairly successful. It was one of the highest grossing softwares in my niche. We had Fortune 100 clients, Disney, Samsung, Sony Pictures. It, for a guy in his early 20s, it really looked like I was pretty cool. Yeah. You know, I was successful, smart, and it was a Revenge of the Nerds kind of thing. It was, I don't have to work at McDonald's and Burger King. I have a software company that I work from home and can travel, and I'm doing what I love, and this is awesome. Then I got introduced to the therapeutic work, NLP hypnotherapy, and then I realized, oh my gosh, I have a lot of stuff to heal. I went into that stuff thinking I was going to come out a Jedi, like, oh, I'm going to have these hypnosis powers and skills, and I can do all this mentalism. First day, I was like, oh my God, I'm a victim. I'm at the effect of everything in my life. And I've played this victim card since I was 4 years old. And so that literally was a turning point in my life of, oh my God, if my life is to change, I need to reverse this. Instead of being at the effect of life, I need to be the cause of my life. And up until that moment at 21 years old, no one ever told me that was possible. Hmm. It was deal with the hands you were dealt. Oh, just be yourself. Pick yourself up by your bootstraps. This is just how life is. Oh, you know, toughen up. All these things, which have good intention and there's some value in them. But nobody said, you know what? You can actually create your reality. Not in a grandiose narcissistic way that I think sometimes it gets conveyed.
Yes.
But literally in a, listen, you don't have to be a victim. You know, if you take full responsibility for everything in your life, that's how you're going to find your freedom. And so that was what turned me from just wanting to improve myself to get better, socially, romantically, and financially, to saying, oh my gosh, I need to heal. There's a lot of stuff in here to heal. I never cared about healing, therapy. When I would play video games, I thought the cleric was the dumbest, most boring role. And here I am, kind of like a cleric in life. And so that really set in motion my journey, not from just healing, but to being a healer, to actually being of service to others. And so I did that for many years. I started to do coaching. I started to do teaching with very little success, because here's a 24-year-old guy trying to tell you how to be a remarkable lover, to have holistic sex, or to improve your business. And, you know, it just was completely incongruent. I had none of it embodied, but I didn't know that. I didn't know it. I thought I knew all this stuff in my head.
Yeah.
I'm smart enough. I got the skills. I can do this. So fast forward a few years later, my teachings were eventually picked up. They were published by a very large online publisher. All of the spiritual teachers that I studied my name was right up there next to them. And I was like, this is amazing. Like, I did it. Like, Andrew, you finally did it. Like, yeah. you made it. And then 3 months later, I was homeless. I was sleeping in my car in Orange County, California, in LA. And I was like, what the fuck? How is it that I just thought I made it, that I had this great success, and it's barely selling any? They can't market it because it's on the topic of sex. You can't run ads on that. And I wasn't making any income. I was despising being a programmer and a web designer because I'm like, I got all this spiritual wisdom. Why am I behind a computer doing JavaScript and CSS when I know secrets to the universe? I was like, man, and so my ego came in. And so it was just this downward spiral of how could I be so smart, have so much success, and understand all of these things, and yet not be able to afford rent?
Yeah.
And that set in motion from there many years of struggle. After my software company went down, the industry changed, the technology went out of favor, became defunct. I wanted to do the healing. I wanted to do the spirituality work, and I just couldn't get it to work. I was in LA trying to make it like everyone else in LA, and I wasn't. And I was in a fantasy, and I was in denial, and my life was not working. I was introduced to a mentor who has years ago since passed, and he was the one that introduced me to the movement work, the embodiment piece. And so that took me, again, after 8 years of doing the best therapies in the world, I was still suffering. And I met him, and it was, I don't want to say it was my last or only hope, but at the time, I had nothing else. I really was at a loss. I was living out of my car, taking my iMac, old giant iMac, out of my trunk every day to go into the public library in Costa Mesa, Orange County, California, lugging in my big library, my big computer into there, not a laptop, big computer,
yeah,
and trying to launch my coaching business from that. And it just didn't work. You know, I spent months building this whole thing. I was focused on completely the wrong stuff. I was just an ego. It was just, I was so caught up in this fantasy, and I was suffering tremendously, and it didn't work. And so I spent months living in my car doing something that didn't pan out. And that was a recurring pattern, spending months building something that nobody wanted, which was just another manifestation of my stories of being unwanted, undesirable, unlovable. Bringing the story back to my mentor. So I met him, and I was introduced to the somatic work. And I saw myself on video moving. And oh my God, I saw somebody that didn't look at all like I pictured myself. Mm. I thought I was smart and cool and sexy and amazing and all of this stuff. And I saw this person who was narcissistic, manipulative, dissociated, in his head, living in a fantasy, passive-aggressive, jealous, megalomaniac, angry, shameful. I saw all of these things in myself on video. And I couldn't run away. I couldn't deny it. I couldn't hide it. I couldn't cancel, clear, heal it, cut it out. I had to face it. And so that started my journey of the embodiment work, and it changed everything. And I realized that this was the missing piece. I had everything up here, almost none of it was in my body.
Yeah.
And let me clarify, when I say embodiment and in my body, I don't mean I don't mean metaphorically. I don't mean, oh, you just walk, you know, you just show up in your life trying to apply these things. I mean literally in my body, in my hands, in my arms, the way that my hips were aligned, the way the things my toes did connecting to the earth, the way my hands stayed small, all of these things, literally my physical body held these energetic stories. And I could see it for myself. It wasn't pseudoscience. It wasn't wacky New Age land theory. It was visible in my body, on the video, nowhere to run, no denying it. And so for about 5 years, I did that work. And it was probably the hardest thing I've ever wanted to do. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. And I wanted to do it, and I had to do it because my life depended on it. And I did it. I approached this work as if my life depended on it, because it did. Because homeless twice, successful, not successful, nothing was working. I saw in myself, in my body, these myths that if they continued to play out, I would have taken myself out in very, like, if you don't think being homeless is taking yourself out enough, there's one or two more levels. And it worked. I finally, after 5 years, broke through, had many forms of awakening, enlightenment experiences. I went from being homeless, making many, many six figures, to publishing a book, to having wonderful people in my life, to having beautiful relationships, to traveling, to having a functional life. But most importantly, healing. Most importantly, all of that stuff that I was using to suffer. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say every little 1 ounce. No, there's stuff still there lurking. But enough of it, the bulk of it, to make that shift between suffering and being at peace in life, I was able to break through. And the final important aspect of that is that it was not theoretical and it was not impractical. The spiritual and emotional healing and wisdom and transformations I had directly reflected to the success and results and the relationships in my life, in my physical world. And that is a result of the embodiment of taking that spiritual wisdom as above and bringing it below. So as above, so below. But it's also as below, so above. And when I realized that idea, which you could also use another phrase to describe it, how you do one thing is how you do anything.
Yeah.
That made complete sense that, how you move in your body is how you move through your life in the world. And when I was able to shift all of that over a very, very intense process, everything shift inside and outside. And then from there, I wrote my book to describe the things that actually helped me break through when none of the other stuff did. So that's what this book was. What were those things in those 5 years that I figured out then that broke me through, that in the past 12 years didn't break me through? To found Cinesomatics and bring this work out to the world.
Well, thank you for sharing all of that. And it does sound like it was a difficult confrontational process, kind of this unmasking of yourself through the observation of your sort of inherent body language and body grammar, what you are communicating about your own self-belief and your own embodied self through that self-observation, which can be very uncomfortable, in the same way that psychedelic experiences can show us things that are very uncomfortable, and that this is part of the process. And so many elements of your own story are things that I think that a lot of people, the traps that people fall into of kind of mistaking, A, a job or a career as success. That it sounds like even with the computer programming, that as you say, you use the movie title, The Revenge of the Nerds. That it is. It sounds like that was kind of a revenge form for you. That there was. It was feeding that wounded self of like, oh, see how smart I am. And I'm going to be your boss and I'm going to come with this cool stuff on I'm successful. And so, see, but it's still feeding that. It's feeding that.
Revenge is still revenge. Yeah.
Yes. And so then having to kind of go through those rock bottom experiences and the difference between the appearance of success and I think you went through a period, as you've described, that I just kind of call parroting. That I say there's lots of great, quote unquote, teachers out there, but they're parroting what they've learned, and they're not embodying it. They're not really living it, but they've learned the words, they've learned the terminology, and now they're sharing it. And I think that that's a little bit endemic in the self-improvement world. I think there's a lot
of most of it.
Yeah.
It's really most of it. Parroting, I liked it. It's derivative. Almost all of the work out there is derivative. And listen, we're all standing on the shoulders of giants. Now, we've all learned from ourself, our own experiences, other people. You know, it's not like we're owed all the credit. However, there's a difference between parroting things that you've heard and repackaging it versus having the embodied experience and speaking from that.
Yes.
And that was my intention of the book. And if most people that read this book will say, oh my gosh, you know, I haven't read any other book like this. You know, you say things in here that I've never heard before. And for people who've been doing this for 40 years to tell me that is big. Because it's, you know, the industry is a big kind, you know, there's this incestual parroting kind of thing. And there's narcissism in it. There's having masks. You know, people are trying to be like other people. You know, I mean, that's a huge industry, right? You know, I'm an influencer. Buy my course so you could be like me and have my life.
Right.
And I refuse that. I'm like, no, I don't, you're not, when you do my stuff, you're not going to be more like me. You're going to be more you than you've ever been.
Yeah.
And that's what you want to look for, because that's where your true self is found. Because just this parroting stuff, you end up in a loop and you become in an echo chamber and everything looks the same and everybody talks the same and acts the same and the creativity dies and it's a trap.
Yeah. And that's where the clients themselves, I mean, we were speaking of both the teachers and now also the people who are utilizing these programs, that often what I've seen is people go from one to the next. It's like, okay, I've got to get the next program. I've got to go to the next conference. I got to get the next healing modality. And it becomes the next. And they're being told all the same things and all of this. And it's like, oh, and then it even feeds into self-criticism because, oh, I haven't gotten it yet. And then there's that classic, oh, well, just fake it till you make it. And I think you tried that. And that it doesn't work.
Because you just get good at faking.
Yeah. Yeah. And underneath it all is still like, I'm a fucking imposter. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm making money or I'm being quote unquote successful, but I don't know what I'm doing, you know? And that element of truly being yourself, there comes from this place of really ease and confidence and self-assuredness that is not megamaniacal. I probably butchered that word, but it's coming from a place of self-assuredness and self-confidence and self-love, that knowledge of self-worth, that I am worthy to be myself and I'm worthy to share my ideas and my contributions in a way that perhaps is novel. And it's not just parodied anymore, but it's actually sharing something from that deep embodied experience and wisdom. And those are the teachers that really can help guide people. And it sounds like that's what you've been developing.
Well, I want to take what you said one step further.
Yeah.
And when you said, you know, this knowledge that you're whatever, 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 there's a big difference between knowing this and embodying it, experiencing it.
Yeah.
Because I knew I was lovable, but I didn't feel it.
Right.
I didn't own it. I didn't live as if that was true. And so that's a big place that we can get trapped, is that we get caught in belief. You know, you got to move beyond belief. You got to move beyond thinking. You got to move beyond a mental understanding of your worth. When you embody it, when you feel it, it's undeniable. You don't need to become confident. There's no, you know, you don't go out and say, all right, I got to get into the confidence state and then run this pattern and strategy like, okay, I'm going to do the confidence thing. No. It's exactly what you said. It's embodied. It's there. And it comes from experience, and it comes from a deeper knowing, not a mental knowing. And when you have that, I mean, nothing, you know, nothing else matters.
Yeah, because that's where that centered beingness comes from. Then, you know, I like to tell people, well, at that point, then you've given yourself permission to always be yourself. And so that's all you need to do. So it goes back to that phrase again, like, yeah, be yourself. But now it's not that you quote unquote know how to do it, but you've felt how to do it. And then you can also really distinctly feel when you're off. And you're like, you know what? That doesn't feel right. And it's interesting that sometimes people put themselves back in the box and they never get happier when they do that. Because once you pay attention to the feeling, you know, in the same way that, you know, you might say, I love someone, but when you feel it, it's something different. And if that feeling goes away, then you know that. And so it comes from that place. And so for that level of self-love and that level of self-acceptance and that confidence in I am worthy of being loved because I am love and I'm coming from that place. Once you start operating from there, I don't think anybody ever wants to go back, really, because that's the place of at ease. It's an embodied and also existential being at ease within yourself, I think. So going back into the cinesomatics, and you first encountering this, watching yourself on video, you've mentioned seeing all these things in your body, in your movements, in your posture. So what's the grammar? What's the interpretive frame? And how do these elements get analyzed within this system? So it's kind of a broad question.
No, great question. It's feeling. You were just talking about it. It's feeling-based awareness. It's all symbolic. If you're in your head going down a checklist of body language, it's not it. So what I'm doing as a facilitator is I'm in my body. I'm accessing my feeling place. Now, the thing is, in order to do this, I have to be in relationship with that. I had to do the 15 years of work to be able to access that feeling place without distortion. So the frame of this is reflective. It's a still pond, right? You've heard meditation. You know, the mind is like ripples over a pond, and you stop the wind and you get an accurate image reflected back. Well, that's what I'm doing. That's what I've done in those 15 years to become as still as a pond as I can be, at least in those moments. And what I'm doing is, from that feeling, I'm feeling them. So in a way, it's empathic. So I'm watching them move, and I'm feeling with my eyes in a certain way. I'm looking, I'm watching. But as I'm watching, I'm feeling what the movements feel like to me. Mm-hmm. And that reveals all of this subconscious data. From there, I have to take that symbolic feeling data and then translate it into words to give an image, a picture, an idea of what that thing actually is. Now, I've been doing it for so long, I'm really good at it, and for the most part, it's pretty quick. There are times when it's something so bizarre or something subtle, it takes time for me to feel. It has to percolate a little bit. It's like, what? what is this? And I mean, the things that come through, I mean, you get archetypical stories, you get characters from mythologies, you get people's traumas, you get generational traumas that come through, and they come through the movement, and they come through the feeling and the expression of the feeling. So what I'm doing is feeling that, giving that feedback, and then they're watching themselves on video, seeing if they can see what I'm saying. And if they can, their perception, you know, their perceptive lens opens up a little bit. And after hours, days, weeks, months, even years of doing this work, their capacity to see this, not only in themselves but other people, gets developed and increased. As they're healing their stuff, as they're willing to see that in themselves, they're also willing to see it in others. And so when I'm doing this, I also have to be willing to go wherever the client's going. And that necessitates me being willing and able and comfortable going into the deepest, darkest, and the highest and brightest.
Yeah. So it sounds like you don't have a guidebook over here that's like, okay, well, someone shakes their hands, that means this. Someone looks away, it means that. Because each embodied individual, of course, is unique. It's coming with their own unique life history. There is no universal map here. But even within that, it sounds like there are certain archetypes that can show up.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, you're saying this really well. These archetypes, so there isn't the perfect one way, only way, right way, wrong way. But there is an objective and a subjective layer to this. So these archetypes, and maybe this was going into what you were going to say, one of the ways that we use the work is by having people show specific archetypes. So for example, I'll say, and these archetypes are not necessarily your traditional ones. They're just archetypical ways of the collective unconscious, you know, just how humanity is. So one of the most fundamental ones is giving and receiving. It's a fundamental yin and yang. You know, yin and yang, you know, this is non-dual work, but understanding polarity and duality in life.
Yes.
So give, receive. You know, this is a part, you know, we're in a polarized dualistic physical reality under a non-dual, you know, well, you know all this already.
Yes.
So when we're doing these archetypes, I'll say, all right, well, show me giving, show me receiving. And this is when the stuff gets really juicy, really fun, and we get to see what's going on for them. So to these subjective and objective layers to this, the objective layer is, if I say, show me giving, and someone goes like this, right? So if you can't see this, what I'm doing is I'm reaching out in front of me and pulling it towards my left, towards me.
Yeah.
If you look at that, someone who is functional and properly wired will see that as, that doesn't look like giving. That looks like taking. Well, the client who does that doesn't realize that. To them, that's giving. And what we would call that reverse wired.
Right.
So that person has a reverse wiring, which means that as they go through their life, every time, not every time, but let's just say when they're giving, when they think they're giving in that way, what's actually happening is them taking.
Yeah. What's in it for me? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's how it would translate. But it shows up in the body this way. And it's not accident. That's how they actually show up in life. And so that's the objectiveness to it. You know, there actually literally is a consensus of reality that says, well, when you give, this has to occur. That's the definition of it. When you are making money, well, money from somewhere else is now coming into your possession. If it's not, you're not making money. That it's just verifiably, objectively, not functional. That's not it. But there's a subjective layer to it where there's probably over 1,000 ways somebody can make money functionally, right? There's 1,000 different ways that you can go out in the world making money. You can make money through investing. You could do it for time for your time for money, whatever it is. Giving. There's many different ways and feelings to give. You could give pleasure. You could give a gift. You could give a hug. You could give all these different things show up in different ways. However, underneath all of them is going to have the feeling of giving. And so it's that giving we're looking for and wanting to see if it's functional and accurate or not.
So how about if you're working with someone who is presenting in such a way that the feeling that you're receiving from that is, this is a performance. This person is showing me what they think I think giving is supposed to look like. So they're performing it, but it might not be necessarily their authentic energetic action of what's actually underneath that. So here we're getting into layers of subtlety. So how would you deal with something like that?
Well, I give them feedback.
Yeah. So how does that show up?
Yeah. Well, it does show up. People come on. They have masks. They have manipulations. They have agendas. They they'll come in, and you know, as little kids, they had to. We call it dancing for your dinner. You know, it's a form of energetic, you know, prostituting yourself. You're basically performing for love, money, approval, attention, whatever it is. And it often comes from, you know, the parents. When you have narcissistic parents that say, you know, you have to entertain me and make me happy, you get children who perform. And they don't know themselves. They don't know what that authentic, spontaneous expression is because they're so used to having to perform for love, approval, attention, and whatever. So all of that shows up, and I give feedback on it. I would say, you're performing, you know, this feels like tape, you know, you're not doing this from your authentic place. And then the process is helping them get there. And that process of helping them get there, those layers of subtlety that they penetrate, then becomes the healing. And so, all right, well, you're performing, you're not being who you really are, you have a mask on. Well, how is it showing up in your life? Everywhere. All right. Well, why? What happens if you would stop? Well, blah, blah, blah. And then it becomes the therapeutic aspect
right,
of it.
Right. So it can uncover their projections of what they fear will be revealed if the mask is dropped. So it's almost like, sort of metaphorically, we could describe this as a process of helping people be comfortable being naked in front of somebody else, in a sense of really being authentic and being vulnerable and able to be seen without these masks, without these performances, and without these holding on to these various structures. I'm wondering what happens, or, I mean, of course, this is a willing audience in the sense that people who are coming for this work, they want this reflection, they want this feedback. But even within that, does denial and rejection show up? And then how is that processed and dealt with?
Yeah, well, you know, people will get defensive. You know, their egos come in and starts defending their limitations. And it shows up in very subtle, sophisticated ways. This is advanced work. You know, it's not inexpensive. We work with very, you know, successful, high-functioning people, sometimes, not always. And it really requires commitment because you're going to start seeing things in yourself that you've just spent 40 years of your life trying never to see again. And when people have been doing this stuff for decades, their identities are wound up in it. They're wound up in these stories. And so people come in and often get defensive. Maybe not verbally towards me, but psychologically or emotionally in themselves, they'll shut down, they'll close off. And I can see all of that. And so not only are they getting feedback on the video and the movements, but they're getting feedback in real time on how they're processing the feedback. through the discussion. So I'll say, just notice you're being defensive. And so I always bring the awareness back onto the here, the now, what they're feeling. And I'm always taking them into the feeling. Say, all right, what are you defending? What's underneath this? And so you just go deeper, 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 under. And there's often the breakthroughs. So when they have those breakthroughs and they can penetrate it, they open up. Well, they have this huge healing experience. You know, they don't need to defend it anymore. And so not only is it feedback, I'm teaching, I'm showing them how to communicate, how to take the feedback in, how to feel, how to get out of their head. Because some people will just be in their head. They'll say, oh, yeah, I see it.
Yeah.
Well, you realize we just talked about how you've abandoned yourself for 30 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I see that. I get it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now what?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the technique? How do we fix it? How do we get on? No, stop. Right. So I'm constantly telling people, not what they don't want to hear, but people come in and we've been conditioned for these magic bullets, quick fixes to add on strategies, tactics, techniques. This is a non-rational process, just like psychedelics. It's not a rational process. There's no techniques. I get people to stop everything. This is subtractive.
Yeah.
You stop. No, stop the neurotic fixing. The more you try to fix yourself, the more it validates the lie that you were broken to begin with. And so there's all of this stuff, Martin. All of this stuff, people come in and they present it. And then my job is to give them feedback, to show them they're doing this stuff, and to help guide them and help them heal and penetrate all this stuff to get deeper and deeper and deeper to who they really are. Not to become something
right.
new or that they're right. not, but to stop and subtract all of the stuff that they've adopted in their life, thinking is going to get them the success, the happiness, the love, the joy, the money, whatever, but is actually taking them further away from their true self. Even if on the surface it's helped. That's one of the tricky parts. People come in and say, oh, all this stuff has helped. Yeah, it has. But you've been doing it for 30 years. You've reached an upper limit. What got you here ain't going to get you there.
Yeah. I'm curious about the trajectory of layers that you go through. And I'll just make a comparison here to having worked with people with 5-MeO-DMT that often what I found was that initial sessions are the most explosive and the most kind of chaotically expressed somatically. In other words, in someone's first experience, they might be flipping around, rolling around, screaming, yelling, vomiting. And then the more you can help fine-tune a person's experience to work through that, then it becomes more and more subtle. So for example, I had one individual that I worked with for a number of sessions, and he is someone who started very, very explosively. And by the time we were getting down to kind of our finishing sessions, one of the bits of feedback that I would give him, because at that point he was able to just sit and not be explosive. But I would notice that every once in a while, his eyebrow would shoot up. And so I mentioned to him, I said, I think every time you become self-conscious, you move your eyebrow. He's like, really? You think so? He's like, well, let's try it again. So then we went for another round of medicine. And then and he asked, like, well, could you point it out when I do it? And I was like, okay, there it is. There it is. There it is. So it went from very big demonstrations to smaller and smaller demonstrations of where he was inhabiting sort of that self-story and that self-limitation. And then I've also found that at certain times it gets kind of smaller and more subtle. And then there might be one last big, even more explosive, as right as they're reaching the point of really encountering themselves and really accepting that, where it gets very big again. So I'm just curious about the trajectory of doing this kind of work. If you see similar trajectories, or is it different?
Well, let me first touch on what you said about that last final thing. I do see that the closer we get to touching and penetrating that core of whatever it is, oftentimes people will get more defensive. So very, very similar, you know, reaction. As my clients and students progress, you know, they do that less and less and less, and and they become much more open. So over time, it generally does get more, it does get easier because they're learning and they're making the shifts and they're more open and everything. Every client that comes in is different. I mean, some come in and are just like completely shut off and I just can't, there's no access. They don't let anybody in. And I'm like, I can feel you up until that. You know, I know there's tremendous suffering, but you're not letting me in. You know, this isn't going to move forward until you start feeling. So that's one of the biggest things is if the participant, and everybody, nobody says they're not willing to feel. The problem is it comes from their head versus their body. Their body doesn't want to feel. The body isn't going to feel, but their head's like, yeah, sure. That's what I'm here to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well then feel it.
I don't know how.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a great ego strategy. I don't know how to feel. All right. Well then show me not feeling. Okay. All right. Well now do the opposite. And so we have some of those like secret weapons like that. Some tricks up our sleeve to when people, it's like a Zen koan, right? You know, it's these, the Zen master has, you know, all right, when he sees the student is up against it, he'll give the thing, he'll have them do the thing that he can see will help them. So there's a lot of that. In my job, there's a lot of times that I see all of this stuff that's going on for them, but I can't do it for them. And they have to discover a lot of it themselves because I'm not going to rob them of the experience. You know, they have to come to the conclusions themselves. So I don't give advice. I don't tell them what to do or not to do. Yeah. I just help them penetrate and remove this stuff. That trajectory, I have clients I've worked with for almost 2 years now, and they're a lot better. and they're a lot better at going in and dealing with the stuff, but there's still some layers, you know, there's still stuff that is buried really, really deep. Even if, you know, even if on the third session, we're talking about something that happened in childhood. So it's a non-linear process because everything connects to something else. So if like I'll do some symbolism work with them, have them look at these pictures and, or do some movement. And then I'll see them react to it in a way that has nothing to do with that thing there, but this reaction is much more interesting. This volatility or reaction has much more healing potential. There's something there. So it doesn't really matter as much about what evokes it, but whatever that thing is that we evoke, then we go there and then we do that. So there's not a linear trajectory because this is not a come in and we'll fix one thing process.
Yeah.
It could be, but how I work with people is just life, you know, it transform your whole life. And so relationships, sex, money, career, health, you know, just everything comes up and sometimes they all come up together. Sometimes there's little silos. But within a few minutes of me watching somebody move, I can have a pretty good idea. I could know probably more than their own family what's going on in their lives just from a minute or two of moving.
Yeah. And it sounds like there's a great deal of immediacy to it, that it's dealing with what arises when it arises and following that thread and seeing where it leads. And again, not working from a program. Not that we're going to take you from A to B to C to D, and then, you know, by the time you get to Z, you're all done, you've graduated, you get your diploma. But it's looking at what arises, unraveling that, embodying something new, then seeing what else arises, unraveling that, and embodying something new. And hopefully, it sounds like finding greater freedom and authenticity and beingness in the process.
Yeah, and that's how you live your life. Because I remember when I was trying to fix myself, I was waiting for the end.
Yeah. The make it point.
Yeah, exactly. The make it point. And I realized, oh my God, this is never going to come. I'm going to spend my whole life in this room tapping, doing this stuff to heal that helps. And it did help and it did heal, but there was never end. And so the same things that we do in session is how we live our life. You're going to be out in life. Things are going to happen. Well, you deal with it as it comes. And then the same way you deal with it in the sessions is going to be how you do it in your life. And if we can help them change that and bring a great level of mindfulness and self-awareness, then they're going to be self-reliant. Now, they don't have to depend on me or a guru or, you know, someone else. You know, they can move through the world in a new way.
Yeah. Become your own person.
Yeah. Imagine that.
Yeah. So how does the process works in terms of, you know, so we've got your website right here. I'm going to mention the name again. It's cinesomatics.org. So C-I-N-E as in cinema, S-O-M-A-T-I-C-S.org. And that's the Center for Cinesomatic Development. So if someone wants to pursue this, what is the process? Where do they begin?
Well, I'm actually going to give you another website. It'll be andrewdaniel.org, which is my personal website.
Okay.
And if you want to work with me and do that, then the first step I would suggest is getting the book. Because my book, Awaken to Your True Self, lays the foundational concepts. I go into embodiment later in the book. There's actually an exercise there. If people want to try it themselves, there's an adopted cinesomatic exercise in there, in the book. And so get the book. If it helps, if you resonate with it, if it makes sense, go to my website. I do have openings for assessments. So what you'll do is you'll do an embodiment assessment. And we get on a 2-hour call and we'll do cinesomatics. We'll have you to move in your body. We'll record it, play it back, and you'll get to see the truth about how you're showing up in your life. Hmm.
And then
also have some workshops as well, too. Those are coming up.
Yeah. Well, so what are those? Go ahead. You can tell us about them.
Okay. Depending on when this comes out, but we'll have more throughout the year and for years to come. We have one coming up that's an online virtual workshop. It's a 2-day workshop where we do dance, movement in a group. We have discussions. And so it's the entry level workshop. It's called Cinesomatic Exploration. Then we also have one that's called Cinesomatic Slackline. And this is where we get you on a slackline, which is like a tightrope, and you have assistants to help you walk it. And we film you using our cinema equipment, very high grade Hollywood level cinema equipment. And we record you walking on this slackline. And then we play it back again with the high tech equipment. And the way you walk on this line is the way you walk through your life. And so your entire life will play out in the way that you walk on the slack line. And then that's on the first day. And the second day, then you get an opportunity to choose to make a new choice, to walk through your life in a new way. So that's Cinesomatic Slackline. That one's an in-person one. And right now, that's going to be in Nashville, Tennessee.
Hmm. So why the high-grade film equipment? What does that make accessible in a way that maybe, say, filming on an iPhone or something doesn't cut?
Really good question. I like it. I like to get nerdy and technical with this stuff. Most people don't give a shit. So it's all about data. It's all about information. So I can do this in real time, but stuff will slip by. So we film it. A, so you get to see it yourself. B, the high quality cinema equipment lets us go in super slow motion and super high speeds. And the displays we have also show about 4 times as much data per second as a traditional screen and TV would. And so what you get to do is when you're doing these movements, in a 5 second dance, in a 5 second handshake, in a 5 second movement, there could be enough data to talk about, you know, for 5 hours. So what this high-tech equipment allows us to do is capture more data. And within that data, we can dive deeper and say, oh, we missed this. There's this super, super subconscious, unconscious myth that's running this at this slow speed. Oh, do you see the way that you're interacting with that person? Look at that glance you gave that person. Wow, that was very maniacal. Oh, that was very seductive. And so in just a moment, those things happen and it can reveal how people are interacting with each other. Because not only is this a one-on-one, but it's groups. We have group dynamics where people are interacting with each other. And you see the masculine and feminine, you see all sorts of more things happening there. But yeah, the high-tech equipment just allows us to have such much more detail that we can use in the feedback process.
Oh, fantastic. The question I would like to ask is kind of relates to diversity in different population demographics. And I'm just curious, in working with different people, you know, it might be limited by who's coming for these kinds of workshops, so you might not have access to all this information. But I'm always curious between potential differences between men and women, people who are differently gendered or differently identified in terms of, you know, masculine or feminine, and also, you know, different demographics of, you know, many of the subcultures, for example, in the United States, different subcultures adopt different ways of speaking, different inflections, different ways of gesticulating or body language, right? So there's all these different subcultures. So I'm curious, is there anything that you've found there that you feel is relevant, or is it still just each person is unique? We're dealing just with this person. But I'm curious about where the categories that people might identify within, is that playing an impact into how the analysis helps unravel for them?
Great question. Oh, these are such great questions. Yes. So not only do we have personal mythologies, but we have cultural mythologies. So a really good way to understand this is just very, very superficially in stereotypes. You see these different stereotypes in different ethnic cultures and groups around the world. There's a reason. It doesn't mean the stereotypes are true for everybody or they're accurate or they're even, you know, most of them are very unhelpful and, you know, offensive. But it does show us that different cultural groups have different ways of being. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, I work with someone from Switzerland. Well, the Germans and the Swiss have a completely different relationship with feeling and warm, fuzzy emotions than somebody in Latin America.
Yeah.
And so those are some very basic things. Then you have in Asian countries. So I work with people all around the world, people from India, Africa, all the different Asian countries, Americas, Canada, everywhere. So I work with people, gay, straight, male, women, old, young. You know, there's, you know, work with everyone here. And there are some patterns, right? So there are cultural myths. So for instance, in a lot of Asian cultures, there are, you know, this doctor, lawyer, the parents have this huge expectation of the children, all performance-based, you know, so it's not in everybody, but those stories do play through. There is gravitas of these cultural myths that play through different cultures. And when they don't play through, it's really interesting to see why. Oh, you grew up in this environment. That's why those didn't affect you. Oh, that's amazing. And it's – so – one time I worked with someone from India, and this subconscious caste system still playing out. You could see it playing out in the movements of where they were and related to in the caste system, even though they weren't really in that caste system in their life. And so, yeah, there is such a richness in all these different cultures and ways of being. Now, some of those are functional, and a lot of those are not functional. And what we're doing in this work is to help stop some of those. You know, there are some, there's a lot of abusive and destructive and limiting cultural myths and stories and ways of being, even familial. So our families, our small tribe, and even bigger, you know, genetic cultures, there's some things there that don't serve. And so my clients are incredible because they have the courage to be some of the ones to stop, you know, to stop generations of trauma and abuse. And it is remarkable seeing some of these people have the courage to say no. You know, everything that their culture told them, you know, to do or not to do that was destructive or abusive, you know, they're not taking a stand necessarily against some government, but they're taking a stand for what they believe in, starting with themselves, starting with their own body, with their own healing. And that's, I really think, one of the most effective ways to evoke change in the world. You know, you become that light. You become an example of, hey, you stopped it. You stopped five generations of alcoholism and abuse. That's amazing. You know, that changes the world.
Yeah. The way that I kind of like to discuss these issues is refer to both. We have the individual ego, the person I think of that I am, but the part of that is made up of what I like to call the meta egos of where I'm identifying beyond my immediate person. So what are my subgroups? What is my culture? What is my religion? What is my ethnicity? What is my identity? And just like within the individual ego, there can be certain aspects that are more functional, more healthy, and more in alignment with who you authentically are. And then there's lots of elements that are dysfunctional and are out of alignment and are limiting. And so we have all these different levels to what the ego actually is and how it's inhabited within the body. And I really like this approach of, again, going directly to the individual, helping the individual clear this stuff out and transform. Because I find that when we're working on the societal level, that just becomes more ego games and becomes more elements of dysfunction, because then it's one identity set versus another identity set. And it's just playing in the polarity without ever getting to the unity. And that's where, if you can live it yourself, embody it yourself, that's the best change you can make for the world. Not your political agenda, not your social agenda. Sometimes those things are significant and important, but the real gift to humanity for transformation is one person at a time, finding their authentic self and living from that place.
That's all I know. I mean, if there's a way to do it, I don't know it. But I think even that one person, you have Martin Luther King, you have a Jesus, you have a Buddha, you have a Gandhi, Mandela. I mean, you have Rosa Parks. I mean, you, Thomas Jefferson, George, you know, all of these people that have defined humanity, that has sent ripples throughout the world. It was one person. It was never some immersive political identity. It comes from a person. And, you know, our culture has gotten so far removed from being in touch with actual real people and is so obsessed with these identity politics. You know, it just becomes more chaos and drama.
Yeah.
So nobody's actually taking ownership from themselves. They turn it into a political whatever.
Yeah, and the projection that gets involved there.
Oh, yeah. Yep, yep.
That whole adversarial nature of things. Oh. Well, Andrew, this has been just a wonderful conversation. I'm really glad to have had you on. I do need to wrap it up because I got to go pick up my son and make a quick stop at the grocery store, you know, normal 3D reality stuff.
Yeah.
But I would just invite anything that you want to say to wrap up, and we can mention the websites again or just anything else that you feel that we haven't covered that you would like to mention. So put the ball in your court there.
Yeah, well, just thank you very much, Martin. I really appreciate this opportunity. I know it's a little not 100% on entheogens, but I hope and I feel that this is a very fitting, relevant conversation because all of this stuff, you know, is part of what we're doing when we're doing these psychedelics.
Yeah.
In a way to do it in life that when we're not on the journeys, we're in our life journeying in these more conscious ways. So thank you very much for this opportunity. Thank you for the really, really great questions. I like diving into some of those nitty gritty things. And yeah, last but not least, if anybody's interested in this stuff, just come and give me a holler, get my book, let me know what you think, and hopefully we'll see you somewhere along the path.
All right. So that's andrewdaniel.org, a man with two first names, and the Center for Cinematic Development of Cinesomatics.org. And the book is Awaken to Your True Self, Why You're Still Stuck and How to Break Through. Great subtitle.
Thanks. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great, Andrew. Thank you.